So here we are on the second Sunday of Easter, the Sunday after Easter, and it's always the Sunday where we hear the story of the guy known as Doubting Thomas. And, this is a bit of a punctuation. When I came 13 years ago, the first book that we read among all our three parishes was by the scholar of the early church, Elaine Pagels. And it was a book called Beyond Belief, and it what it examined. Is there anybody here who remembers that book? You won't be quizzed. What Elaine Pagels examines that in that book is really the relationship between two of the early Christian communities. Remember, especially before Constantine sort of imposed from the top down a kind of uniformity on the church, the early church was really quite diverse. A lot of different theologies, different ways of approaching this new life in Jesus. And Pagels speculates that there was a bit of competition between the community around the disciple John and the community around the disciple Thomas. And so Thomas, in this story, and I hope you recognize, this is an alternate version of the sending of the Holy Spirit. You know, the much better known story is in the book of Acts, the day of Pentecost, tongues of flame, you know, that whole story. That's the sending of the Holy Spirit in a different tradition. This is the John tradition of the Holy Spirit, and Jesus breathes on them and gives them the Holy Spirit.
He carries me off.
He should not.
So I'm not the only one hearing that. There was a kind of tension or competition between these two communities, John and Thomas. And so Thomas, not too hard to see, comes off rather badly in this story. He's not there with the disciples. He does not receive this gift of the Holy Spirit. And then he doubts. And one of the things that gets set up in this is a kind of a false dichotomy between faith and experience. And I'm going to talk about that in a minute. But just to know that there may have been a little bit of early church politics in the way John tells the story, in the way John positions Thomas, who gets cut out of a lot of the important action and shows himself to be a figure that gets kind of chastised by Jesus. So just want to set that up a little bit, and I'm not going to say too much more about it. There's what to me is a very poignant moment, which is the return of Jesus, the appearance of the risen Christ to these disciples who were frightened, huddled in the upper room, afraid. And there are a number of things that really strike me about this encounter. First of all, the words of Jesus, "Peace be with you." Remember, these are the men who had betrayed him, who had abandoned him, who had denied knowing him. And one might imagine that Jesus would return with rather a stern countenance, you know, chastising, you know, why have you done this to me? But the words of Jesus are exactly as they were during his life. I love you always, I love you still, and nothing can separate you from the love that flows through me. Do you not understand that even now? Says Jesus. So there's that. But then there's this other thing. And the image of this, I've got this phrase, it may become part of a poem or something. And the phrase is, even the risen body bears the wounds. Which, you know, is something I've thought about, you know, as I've been working with healing disciplines all my life. And, you know, I think of someone who has spent years in, like, psychoanalysis, and is a changed person, but even the risen body bears the wounds. And I think of Jesus standing there, wounded, this radiant, wounded being.
saying to his disciples, "As the Father sent me, so I sent you." And he bears on his body, in his hands and his feet and his side, the marks of that sending, which is to say, I send you into a world that is dominated by fear, and fearful people harm each other. And your task, as it was mine, is to be a witness to God's love in the world and to invite people to let go of their fear and enter into a much deeper, richer, more abundant life. But it won't be easy, because the momentum of the world is entirely on the side of fear. I bear the marks on my body of that fear. And as the Father has sent me, so I send you. And it's a very humbling and I think profound sort of image of the cost of love and what it really takes and what it has taken. Those figures, you know, I keep reminding us of Mandela and Martin Luther King. You know, they stood as witnesses to love in a world that is frightened, and it cost them. What I would like to talk about really mostly today has to do with faith and what faith really is, because in this, you know, these questions about faith and doubt and believing, and what is it that we're asked to believe and what is it that might appropriately be subject to doubt. And so let's just go right back to that image and Jesus standing there with his disciples, sending them, saying, as the Father sent me, so I send you, to be a witness to love in the world. And then the question you might reasonably ask is this a good thing? Is it a good thing to go into the world as a witness to love? Now you might say, well, of course it is. But actually there are a lot of people who say it's not such a good thing. That there are a lot of people that say, you know, we don't live very long. Life is brutish, nasty, and short. And get everything you can for yourself while you're able, because that's the only meaning of life. And there are a lot of people that live their lives that way. And what I want us to understand is that the response of those two hypothetical figures, each of those is a stance of faith. And I would say faith for the human being, for us. And faith is not a religious phenomenon. You might think that faith means accepting certain religious ideas, but faith is much more basic. Faith is a human phenomenon. Faith has to do with how we live our lives. And so, you know, I've been saying pretty regularly recently, we don't know what we're doing here on this little planet. And I will continue to say that. And I will continue to remind us of the anxiety, if not terror, that subjects us to. And when I say that, we don't really know what we're doing here. Part of what comes with that is uncertainty as to how we are to live. If we don't know why we're living here, how do we know how to live? And to answer that question is the question of faith. How are you going to live your life? What values are you going to give yourself to? And nobody can prove an answer. Nobody can prove to you that it's better, or let's say, nobody can prove to you that the universe has some secret, hidden purpose or meaning. Nobody can prove that to you. And many people live more or less unreflectively. They never sort of rise to that level of saying, how am I going to live my life and what values do I want to affirm and what values am I going to renounce? They don't get to that. But a lot of people are you know, if there is a decision, it makes a huge difference if you live your life according to the sense that there is a purpose and a meaning. I mean, I would use the word God. That God has created the universe, however hidden the purposes are, but that God has created the universe and has created us for purposes which we might not fully understand, but which invite us and say, give yourself to this. But nobody can prove it. And it's really important to understand that when you make that choice, it is the choice of faith. And everybody, whether you're inattentive, whether you're hyper-religious, whatever, everybody is involved in making these faith decisions. Now, a lot of stuff, I mean, I've been fighting a lot. And it feels like the fight sort of intensifies the later into my ministry I get. Not so much questions of faith, to what are you going to give your life, but rather the ideas that, in a sense, fill Christianity. Explanatory ideas, which are often put forth as something that you are to believe. Or even, I mean, that there's a lot of confusion. There always has been confusion about faith and belief. In the Greek, the word is the same, pistis. But it gets translated faith or belief. Very different connotations for us. Ideas are put forward. I mean, I'll hold up the magisterium of the Roman Catholic Church. Ideas put forward which are to be believed. And faith will demand a total commitment. Do you remember Jesus being so critical of the Pharisees when he says, you put forth human ideas and teach them as if they are from God. Mere human ideas as if they are from God. And I want us to be kind of tenacious and a little combative when it comes to human ideas about God. I mean, you know that I have been taking on, like, St. Augustine and St. Anselm for their ideas about original sin, their ideas about substitutionary atonement. I could add Thomas Aquinas for his ideas about transubstantiation. And all of these ideas, I don't want any one of you to believe any of it. You might say, yes, this idea really sheds some good light on a human situation. And that's helpful. But our human ideas don't go beyond that. Our human ideas are not absolute. Our human ideas are simply our attempts to articulate what we believe we understand. And one of the hardest things to really come to terms with is how sinful our human thinking often is. Which is to say, our ideas are not so much sprung from a true search for understanding as they spring out of they serve power. I mean, how many ideas serve power in the world? Test every human idea about God, about the understanding of Jesus' death, about our human situation, about what happens in worship. Test every idea. It's your faithful responsibility to test every idea. One of the things that just grieves me is that the church really does not put forth the simplicity of Jesus' invitation. I want you to experience the love of God, and then I want you to live your lives as witness to that. Pretty much end of the story. I mean, that's kind of the Christian life in a nutshell. But the church presents instead a welter of ideas that are often preposterous. And we present that as if to say, if you want to be a Christian, if you want to be a follower of Jesus, you've got to believe all these ideas. And I want to say as clearly as I can, no, you don't. You do have to make the faith decision to say, yeah, it's better to love than not.
And I want to try to open my heart and participate in this mystery of the universe because I am entrusting myself to the presence of a God whom I can sometimes intuit and many stories are told. And my heart leaps in recognition, sort of like Elizabeth, when she heard the story of Mary's greeting and says, "The babe in my womb leapt for joy when I heard the sound of your greeting." Well, there are some things about true words spoken about God kind of cause that arising, that quickening within ourselves. I recognize that as true. So you will. I hope you are called into the legitimacy of the path of love. And then for the rest of our ideas, a lot of them, sometimes I think so much of our religious life should be like manna. Nourishing for today, but if you try to save it up for thousands of years, manna didn't even last the day. By the next morning, it was rotten, and you needed to gather fresh manna for the day. We need to gather some fresh manna, which is to say, maybe some of the old questions that interested the church 1,800 years ago, 1,500 years ago, 700, maybe we get to ask them and seek in our own words and in our own terms understanding that might present to the world an intelligible version of Christianity, not eliminating the mystery. The mystery is everywhere, and we are surrounded by it, and we are tormented by it. It won't eliminate the mystery, but it will identify where we're really talking about human ideas that, as I say, don't get any free pass. They get shaken and tested and scrutinized and inquired into so that we have some chance that our ideas are true and not in service of power and are really helpful ideas in inviting people into the life of love and service, which none can prove,